have a very good day.
Today is Tuesday, October the 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. The U.S. has agreed to provide humanitarian aid to Afghanistan, but refuses to give political recognition to the country's new Taliban rulers. Aid agencies and advocacy groups are calling for the U.S. to base any aid consideration on the Taliban's commitment to respect for fundamental rights of women and girls.
We've already seen things getting worse in the last month or two. They've said certain things and then they've not respected those commitments. I mean, they disbanded the Ministry of Women's Affairs immediately.
And as the U.S. national rate of COVID-19 infections decline, vaccine mandate for some jobs are pushing some employees to get the shots, while others are protesting.
I'd like to see it well below 10,000 and even much lower than that. But when you're at 95,000, that's still a situation where you have a high degree of dynamic circulation of virus in the community.
And Kenya's Benson Kipruto won the pandemic-delayed Boston Marathon on Monday when the race returned from a 30-month absence with a smaller, socially distanced feel and moved from the spring for the first time in its 125-year history. We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. As the U.S. national rate of COVID-19 infection declines, vaccine mandates for some jobs are pushing some employees to get the shots, while others are protesting. Michelle Quinn has more.
It's a moment that's long been coming in the United States, with 76% of people in the country having had at least one vaccination. Deadlines are approaching fast in workplaces, requiring employees to get the shot against COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, or risk losing their jobs. That has resulted in some pushback from employees. In Los Angeles, the sheriff said he will not enforce the county's vaccine mandate when it comes to his 18,000 employees. Alex Villanueva spoke on Facebook Live.
There are entire groups of employees that are willing to be fired and laid off rather than get vaccinated. So I don't want to be in a position to lose 5-10% of my workforce overnight on a vaccine mandate.
These tensions come as the U.S. daily rate of COVID-19 infections has declined to about 95,000 new cases. That's a drop from a high during the most recent peak in September of 172,000 a day, according to the Johns Hopkins University, which is tracking the global outbreak. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, told CNN's State of the Union program he is optimistic about the pandemic's trajectory, but it's too soon to roll back pandemic restrictions such as masking.
I'd like to see it well below 10,000 and even much lower than that. But when you're at 95,000, that's still a situation where you have a high degree of dynamic circulation of virus in the community.
Health officials are expected to meet later this month to discuss Pfizer's application for emergency approval for children aged 5 to 11 to get its vaccine. Pfizer has proposed giving children one-third of the adult dosage. Former Food and Drug Administration head Scott Gottlieb, who sits on Pfizer's board, told CBS's Face the Nation that vaccine mandates for school children will likely be years off.
12 to 17 could be a couple of years away, perhaps a little longer. I think 5 to 11 is even longer than that. You're going to want to get more experience in those children.
Meanwhile, the Biden administration has pledged $1 billion to purchase millions of at-home rapid COVID-19 tests amid reports of test kit shortages around the country. By December, the White House says it will have a supply of 200 million kits per month. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
California has hit a once unfathomable milestone in the virus pandemic. AP Washington correspondent Saga Megani reports.
The state has topped 70,000 COVID-19 deaths, most in the nation. Johns Hopkins University's tally shows that surpasses Texas by about 3,000 deaths and Florida by 13,000, despite California's per capita fatality rate being in the country's bottom third, and it's seeing the lowest rate of new cases in the country. The national average of daily cases has dropped below 100,000 for the first time in more than 2 months. Daily deaths are about 1,700, down from more than 2,000 3 weeks ago. Sagar Magani, Washington.
And the U.S. has agreed to provide humanitarian aid to a desperately poor Afghanistan on the brink of an economic disaster while refusing to give political recognition to the country's new Taliban rulers.
The statements come at the end of the first direct talks between the former foes since the chaotic withdrawal of U.S. troops at the end of August. The Taliban says the discussions went well, with Washington freeing up humanitarian aid for the country. However, the U.S. team's statement was less definitive, saying only that the two sides discussed provision of robust humanitarian assistance directly to the Afghan people. The U.S. also added the current talks being in no way a preamble to recognition of the Taliban. State Department spokesman Ned Price calls the discussions candid and professional, with the U.S. side reiterating that the Taliban will be judged on their actions, not only their words. In his statement, he said the delegation focused on security and terrorism concerns and safe passage for U.S. citizens, other foreign nationals, and our Afghan partners, as well as on human rights, including the meaningful participation of women and girls in all aspects of Afghan society. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The State Department says that the weekend talks in Doha, Qatar, focused on security and terrorism concerns and a safe passage for U.S. citizens and other foreign nationals and Afghans. They also discussed human rights, including for women. And yesterday, October 11th, was the International Day of the Girl Child, a day that highlights the challenges that girls face and encourages everyone to empower the women of tomorrow. Pakistani Nobel Peace Prize winner Malala Yousafzai, who was shot by a Taliban gunman in Pakistan as she left school in 2012, called on the international community not to compromise on the protection of Afghan women's rights. It is a call echoed by Refugees International, a global advocacy organization, which says that as countries take the first steps to engage with the Taliban, they should demand that women's rights are protected. Devon Kohn is the senior advocate for women and girls at Refugees International. She is the author of a new report titled Afghan Women and Girls Under Immediate Threat. The responsibility to protect and assist is just the beginning. In the second part of our conversation, Ms. Kohn says that as the United States and the international community engage with the Taliban, they must also focus on a gender-sensitive response to the deteriorating humanitarian situation in the country.
Is it possible that we haven't seen the worst yet in terms of how or to which extent the Taliban are willing to reverse those gains made by the women's movement in the country? There are thousands of Afghan women who achieved a lot of professional success over the years after the Taliban lost power. Many continue to challenge the patriarchal and ultra-conservative society. Is it possible that things would get worse from here?
I think it's definitely possible that things will get worse from here. I mean, the Taliban have demonstrated and want to demonstrate that they are in control. Now, will they be pragmatic and make decisions that help them gain legitimacy in the international community? Possibly, but I think that, there's very well a possibility that things will get worse. And we've already seen things getting worse in the last month or two. They've said certain things and they've not respected those commitments. I mean, they disbanded the Ministry of Women's Affairs immediately and replaced it with, as people call it, a moral police. But, they replaced it with a different ministry that is to enforce restrictions on women and girls and others. So I think that we certainly haven't seen the worst of it. It's possible to get worse, but I think we as the international community and as, donor countries like the U.S., we do have some leverage, and you know, they want international legitimacy.
Right, which brings me to our last question, Devon. What can the U.S. government do, especially since many of the women, you know, there are thousands of women who helped the U.S. government or were part of the U.S. government programs and will likely be targeted by the Taliban. I see that your report is calling for a gender-sensitive response to the humanitarian situation. What would that look like?
So a gender-sensitive response to the humanitarian situation would include a couple key points and key measures. One, it would ensure that women are part of the frontline humanitarian response. And by that, I mean that they're working for these agencies and that we ensure and force the Taliban's hand to say, women have to be working in these organizations. The only way to access women in humanitarian operations in Afghanistan is to have women be part of the response. And so I think that's a key red line and point that needs to be taken. The second thing is that when we make decisions as policymakers, we need to recognize the gender differences and gender-specific issues and challenges that especially women and girls in Afghanistan face. So, for example, one of the things I bring up in the report is IDs. You know, a lot of women in Afghanistan don't have identification documents. Mm. And so, you know, if the U.S. is making policies around resettlement that require documentation that women might not have, then they're being left out. And so I think that, you know, that is what a gender-sensitive response looks like in terms of humanitarian aid, and then also in terms of ensuring that Afghan women and girls have access to international protection. And I think that exactly what you said, there are thousands, if not more, women, Afghan women, that have worked on behalf of the U.S. government, but also on promoting ideals that the U.S. government also promoted and encouraged. And we have a responsibility to those women and girls. And that responsibility has many parts, but two of the key parts of that are, again, having a gender-sensitive humanitarian response and ensuring that women are involved and ensuring that women and girls can exit Afghanistan safely and that they can get resettlement and protection in the U.S. or other safe locations. So I think that those are two key points that the report focuses on, but those are key issues that the U.S. and other governments need to take into account and really need to keep front of mind.
Devon Kohn is the senior advocate for women and girls at Refugees International. She's the author of a new report titled Afghan Women and Girls Under Immediate Threat. The responsibility to protect and assist is just the beginning. And to listen to the first part of our conversation, visit the International Edition page at voanews.com. Three U.S. best economists won the 2021 Nobel Prize in Economics on Monday for natural experiments or drawing conclusions from unintended experiments. The Academy said the three have completely reshaped empirical work in the economic sciences. Göran Hansson, Secretary General of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, announced the winners.
The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has today decided to award Sveriges Riksbank Prize in Economic Sciences in memory of Alfred Nobel, with one half to David Card for his empirical contributions to labor economics, and the other half jointly to Joshua D. Angrist and Guido W. Imbens for their methodological contributions to the analysis of causal relationships.
Three winners are David Card with the University of California at Berkeley, Joshua Angrist with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Guido Imbens with Stanford University. The Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences was not included in Alfred Nobel's will. It was created in 1968 by the Swedish Central Bank in memory of Alfred Nobel to mark its 300th anniversary. It was first awarded in 1969 and has been funded by the bank since then. A senior UN official warns that conditions for millions of Yemenis are horrendous and getting worse as prospects for a political solution remain elusive as the country enters its seventh year of conflict. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations has described Yemen as the world's largest humanitarian crisis. The UN reports 20 million people, or two-thirds of the population, need humanitarian aid to survive. 5 million people are on the verge of famine, and nearly 400,000 children are at imminent risk of death. David Gressley is UN resident and humanitarian coordinator in Yemen. Behind these numbers, he says, are people struggling every day to find food to eat, clean water to drink, and medicine to cure diseases. Gressley says he has spent the last 6 months traveling the country trying to see what is happening on the ground, to see how people have managed to keep going under these conditions. Wherever he goes, he says, people grab him, eager to tell their stories.
I would be told, as they hold on to me, mothers talking about their children not having access to school, the fact that they face problems with landmines, the fact that they can't go, the fisheries are no longer working, so they don't have a livelihood. They can't access water. This is a tragedy that goes all the way across Yemen. That kind of blockage to access to public services.
Gressley says fighting continues along the front lines, and the devastation and evidence of economic collapse can be seen everywhere. He says the consequences of economic collapse are cruel and are driving the unfolding humanitarian catastrophe to new heights.
What I worry about as much as anything right now is the lack of fuel for hospitals, for water systems to keep those systems going. I worry about the fact that public servants don't get paid. How long will they continue to work? They've not been paid since last year. So all of these things are slowly degrading the life of the average Yemeni.
Yemen has been mired in civil war since 2014. The fighting involves the Yemeni government, supported by a Saudi-led coalition, and Iran-backed Houthi rebels. Gressley says he believes the pattern of endless crisis in Yemen and people's hope for a better future are achievable if three critical actions are taken. He says international donors must continue to support the humanitarian needs of the people of Yemen. He says urgent efforts are needed to boost the country's shattered economy so businesses and livelihoods can be restored. Lastly, he says strong efforts are required to support an inclusive political process that will finally bring peace to this devastated land. Experts say Yemeni civilians are being used as fodder by the government, Houthi rebels, and their foreign enablers in their fight for control of the country. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A fire on Monday at one of Lebanon's main oil storage facilities is the latest challenge to the country's electric power supply. Over the weekend, fuel shortages forced the shutdown of Lebanon's two biggest power plants, plunging large parts of the beleaguered country into total darkness. Observers warn that the dire situation can't continue as the energy and interior ministers investigate. And for VOA, Del Gavlak reports from Amman.
Civil defense units took several hours Monday morning to extinguish the blaze at the Zahrani oil installation near one of Lebanon's main power stations, located some 8 kilometers outside the southern city of Sidon on the Mediterranean coast. While firefighters battled the blaze, the Lebanese army cooled nearby fuel tanks to prevent them from catching fire and diverted traffic away from the area amid fears of a potential explosion. Energy Minister Walid Fayyad said the fire broke out abruptly during the transfer of gasoline from one tank to another ahead of delivery, adding a probe will reveal the causes of the fire, according to the National News Agency. This latest incident underscores the extreme fragility of Lebanon's energy infrastructure as fuel shortages forced the shutdown of power plants at Zahrani and Deir Ahmar in the north over the weekend, depriving ordinary Lebanese of even the 1 to 2 hours a day of electricity they were receiving. Power was restored Sunday to the levels before the blackout after the Lebanese army provided 6,000 kiloliters of gas oil to the two power stations, the energy ministry said. The Lebanese have struggled with meager supplies of state-generated power for months amid a fuel shortage which many blame on supplies being smuggled to neighboring Syria, where they were sold for more money. Meanwhile, Iran-backed Hezbollah militia and political party, the country's power broker, has brought in Iranian fuel despite the threat of sanctions. Professor Habib Malik of the Lebanese American University told VOA that the situation is untenable and urged the U.S. and European allies to help Lebanon.
Fuel, diesel oil, these things are absolutely vital for a country, Lebanon. It'll either totally collapse or fall in the wrong hands. It seemed to be now, of course, falling deeper into the wrong hands. This comes after a year and a half of total neglect, and none of this is comprehensible. It doesn't cost much to make a difference in Lebanon. Just get the monkey of the mafia militia cartel off our back.
Malik says a U.S. plan for supplying electricity to Lebanon with help from Egypt, Jordan, and Syria has been too slow. Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Makati met Jordan's King Abdullah in Amman Sunday, where he was promised support, while a Beirut visit by Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian with promises of additional fuel drew local criticism. Lebanon's influential Maronite Catholic Patriarch Bashara Boutros al-Rai on Sunday said that as much as Lebanon needs the help of its friends in international monetary institutions, the state must preserve the country's independence, sovereignty, and normal relations so that some in-kind aid is not a cover for dominating Lebanon and undermining its identity. Beirut's Nida al-Watan newspaper said observers understood the remark as expressing concern over the danger of annexing the country to the Iranian agenda under the guise of aiding it in oil, electricity, and development. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
And in other news, Kenya's Benson Kipruto won the pandemic-delayed Boston Marathon on Monday when the race returned from a 30-month absence with a smaller socially distanced feel, and it was moved from the spring for the first time in its 125-year history. Diana Kipyegei won the women's race to complete the eighth Kenyan sweep since 2000. And pharmaceutical giant Merck is asking the Food and Drug Administration to grant it emergency use authorization for its experimental COVID-19 antiviral treatment. An authorization from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration could help change clinical management of COVID-19 as the pill can be taken at home. And for more on this story and other breaking global news, visit our website at voanews.com. And while there, check out our other programs, including podcasts of shows like Upfront, our television show Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and others. And remember to connect with us on our YouTube channel. Search for VOA Africa. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. According to a new study from the United Kingdom's University of Bath, among those who have survived the mass extinction that wiped out the dinosaur were a few snake species. Not only did they not make it through the KT event, but snakes also thrived and expanded into between the 3 and 4,000 species that live today.
This is Science in a Minute.
Around 66 million years ago, nearly three-quarters of the world's plant and animal species, including the dinosaurs, were eliminated by what scientists call the Cretaceous-Tertiary, or KT, extinction event. According to a new study from the United Kingdom's University of Bath, among those that survived the mass extinction were a few snake species. Not only did they make it through the KT event, but snakes also thrived and expanded into between the 3 to 4,000 species that live today. The study, published in the journal Nature Communications, suggests snakes were able to survive the mass extinction because they sheltered underground and were able to live without food for long periods. The study also proposes that snakes were able to move and adapt to new locations and habitats around the world by filling the voids opened by the disappearance of competitive and enemy creatures. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Voice of America!
International Edition continues. The marathon COVID-19 lockdown in Australia's biggest city, Sydney, ended on Monday for vaccinated residents. Stay-at-home orders imposed on June 26th have been lifted. From Sydney, Phil Massa reports.
What will you do first? Dance?
Government advertisements have urged Australians to be vaccinated against COVID-19, promising that freedoms would be returned when vaccination rates passed certain milestones. The message has been getting through to the community. A 106-day lockdown in the New South Wales state capital, Sydney, was lifted Monday because inoculation rates have passed 70% for people aged 16 and older. Gyms, restaurants and hairdressers have reopened for the first time since late June. Small gatherings at home are now permitted, and larger groups are allowed to meet at parks and beaches. However, the freedoms apply only to those who've been fully vaccinated. However, all residents still face restrictions on travel beyond Sydney. Those rules will be eased when vaccination rates in New South Wales reach 80%. At that point, international travel, which has been heavily restricted since March 2020, will resume. But authorities expect coronavirus infections to increase as restrictions are lifted. New South Wales State Premier Dominic Perrottet says a cautious, staged approach to reopening is needed.
There's going to be challenges as we move through this period. I think we're the first state in the nation that's going down a path where those coming out to visit pubs and restaurants and cafes need to be double vaccinated. That will have its challenges along the way, but I think if everyone treats it each other with respect and kindness during this period, we're going to open up safely.
Vaccinations are mandatory in Australia for health workers, some teachers and other occupations. The country's drug regulator has said the vaccines are safe and effective. Yet research shows that about 10% of Australians are hesitant about receiving a COVID-19 shot. Sydney resident Jamal Dawood says he doesn't trust the safety of vaccines.
I don't believe the pandemic is deadly to the point of enforcing people to take a vaccine that was not proven to be safe. We don't have enough data that this vaccine is safe.
In New South Wales, all restrictions on unvaccinated residents will be lifted when immunisation rates reach 90%. Millions of people, however, remain in lockdown in the Australian cities of Melbourne and Canberra. Australia has diagnosed 127,500 coronavirus infections since the start of the pandemic. More than 1,400 people have died. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A car bomb targeting the governor's convoy shook Yemeni's southern port city of Aden on Sunday, killing several people, security and military sources said. Lauren Anthony of Reuters reports.
A car bomb targeting the governor's convoy shook the Yemeni city of Aden on Sunday. Several people were killed and injured in the attack, according to security and military sources. Governor Ahmed Lamlas and Agriculture Minister Salem Al-Sukatri survived what the state news agency called a terrorist assassination attempt. Both are members of a southern separatist group known as the Southern Transitional Council. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but an STC spokesman blamed Islamist militant groups in a statement. Lamlas is Secretary General of the STC, which has vied with the Saudi-backed government for control of Aden and Yemen's wider south. The government and the STC are nominal allies under a coalition led by Saudi Arabia, which have together been battling the Iran-aligned Houthi movement. Riyadh had brokered a deal to end the power struggle, including forming a new cabinet that includes STC members. But tensions have simmered regardless. The STC has also seen infighting among its ranks. Instability in the south complicates United Nations-led peace efforts to end the war in Yemen, which has killed tens of thousands of people and left 80% of the population reliant on aid. The government is based in the south of the country, while the Houthis control most of the north.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great week ahead.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization
and Africa Center for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands with soap and water or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa Center for Disease Control. And remember to listen to